Drive Time on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When it comes to pensions, performance counts. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Drive Time on RTE Radio 1.
Hamas launched a barrage of rockets and sent a wave of fighters who gunned down civilians.
A shocking hostage taking of more than 100 Israelis.
The military pounded the Palestinian enclave with airstrikes in the last 24 hours.
Now we argue about how many people are killed. I know the names of those people who were killed.
Hamas is using the houses of civilians in Gaza so he can shoot 1,000 missiles a day.
Electricity, food, water and gas supplies have been cut off.
Everything is running short, including the fuel for the generators.
Us as Israel, if we give our enemy fuel, they will abuse it.
They are fighting for war, they are fighting each other.
This is Israel's 9/11.
On October 7th, Hamas militants stormed across the Israeli border with Gaza. The attack killed 1,200 people and 251 were taken hostage. In response, Israel launched a military bombardment of Gaza. Palestinian health authorities say Israel's military campaign in Gaza has killed almost 42,000 people, mostly civilians, over the past year and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes. Over four programmes, we will chronicle the year's events from the Hamas attack to the ongoing war in Gaza and the real risk of Middle East conflict in the wider region. In this final episode, we focus on the period from August to the present day. A US-backed ceasefire proposal fails to find a resolution to the deadly conflict. The Gaza death toll is over 40,000 and those injured approaches 100,000. Vast tracts of Gaza now lie in ruins, with crippling blockades of food and medicine making life unbearable for citizens. The Israeli army launched its biggest assault on the West Bank in decades, and there are fears of an all-out war between Israel and Lebanon after a dramatic escalation in Israeli strikes in late September on the country. This is part four of the war in Gaza.
As August approached, Gaza's remaining hospitals were struggling to cope with waves of bomb blast victims amid fuel and aid shortages. We hear now from Dr. Ahmed Youssef, who had just returned to the US after a stint working in the Al-Aqsa Hospital in the Gazan city of Deir al-Balah.
Dr. Ahmed Youssef is an American doctor who last week returned from Gaza, where he was working in the emergency department of the Al-Aqsa Hospital in the city of Deir al-Balah. You just got back to your family in Arkansas on Thursday. How is it to be home?
It's always bittersweet when you come home to people who love you and you know that also you had to leave a place where people don't get a chance to leave. I've been on, you know, 10 plus other medical missions in different situations that were all difficult. It's always hard. You know, that's the reason these missions exist. But there is all 10 of those, you know, times 100 were not nearly as difficult as an experience in regards to just the carnage and the harm and the human suffering that we saw on this trip. It was surreal, and even speaking about it now, processing it, it's a remarkable experience. I really can't really put completely into words. The entire infrastructure of healthcare in Gaza has been systematically destroyed, and so there's only three public hospitals left, Al-Aqsa being one of them, and it was never meant to be a trauma hospital, but every hospital is a trauma hospital now in Gaza. And what we would have is a combination of medical patients that are overloading the healthcare infrastructure because there's no medications, no refrigerations for insulin and those type of things. And so the ER is full of people just ill from the exacerbations of their chronic medical problems. And then every 6 to 12 hours, we would get a mass casualty event where we would have people, children, you know, women, civilians coming in pieces to the hospital, in different stages of death and dying. The experience of really feeling for the first time in my career that no matter how well I was trained and no matter how long I've been doing this, that so many people, we just couldn't help. There was a helplessness and a hopelessness in recognizing that many of the people that were coming to our doors with their family members holding them in their arms were not going to be able to be helped because there were no supplies. We didn't have enough hands and bodies to help, and we didn't have space. And so this was a constant triaging who gets to live and die is a theoretical thing in when we live in the first world that we live in and are quite privileged. And unfortunately, on the ground in Gaza, it's an hour-to-hour reality.
Israeli public opinion still supported the action of their armed forces and the policy of their government during this time. As we hear now from the editor of the Jerusalem Post, Zvika Klein, when he talked to us on August the 8th, after Norwegian diplomats were sanctioned by Israel.
The Israeli government has today revoked the accreditation of 8 Norwegian diplomats working as representatives to the Palestinian Authority. Norway's foreign minister has called it an extreme act. Spain and Ireland, along with Norway, officially recognised a Palestinian state in May. So, is Ireland next to be sanctioned by the Israelis? Well, to find out more, we're joined now from Israel by Zvika Klein, who is editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. And Zvika, thank you for joining us on the programme this afternoon. Perhaps we might start with this news in relation to Norway. Can you tell us, when was this sanction imposed on Norway and what will it mean?
Right. So basically today it was announced that, you know, the Norwegians announced in response to the decision by Foreign Minister Israel Katz, as you mentioned, that 8 representatives in the Norwegian embassy in Israel, those who are responsible for the relationship with the Palestinian Authority, will not be able to continue with their diplomatic visas and reside in Israel. And as you said, that is a response to a number of actions that Norway has implemented towards Israel. One of them being, as you mentioned, the acknowledgement of a Palestinian state while Israel is at war with, you know, what it represents. Okay, so October 7th, let's remind the listeners, 1,200 Israelis were killed, murdered in their homes, kidnapped, a few hundred of them were kidnapped, put in tunnels underground. Children as young as 9 months old were kidnapped. Women were raped. Their breasts were cut with knives.
I do understand that, and we have covered that in detail on the program. But
100%. So therefore, as a democratic country, the Israeli military has fought in Gaza in order to release our hostages. Most of them being civilians who haven't done anything. Actually, people who were killed and hostage were actually peace activists who drove, you know, Palestinians from Gaza to the hospital in Israel on a weekly basis. Our army was forceful because on the other side, there's a terrorist organization. And I just wanted to add, I think,
to interrupt you there, because there's an army being forceful, and then there's an army or a prime minister under investigation who has an application put in by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. It's very different to being forceful. And I've read out to you there the evidence that the ICC prosecutor believes that he has in relation to that. Can I ask you, do you think it is likely that Ireland
I would like to respond to that, and I'm not like a huge supporter of the prime minister necessarily, but you know, there's so many other countries around the world that are abusing civil rights. But they're not under investigation. Where was the world when Assad killed millions? People weren't going out in the streets, and they weren't going to the ICJ. So I think it's definitely, it's a bit hypocritical.
On the other side, some academics were calling for a boycott of Israel because of their actions in Gaza, such as Irish lawyer Professor Conor Gearty, here on August the 12th. Now, a leading Irish human rights expert has called on governments around the world to support the International Court of Justice findings against Israel with a boycott. Professor Conor Gearty from the London School of Economics says it's not enough to just protest diplomatically, and that Israel's actions in its war on Palestine should be met internationally with economic and academic boycotts. Professor Gearty, author of Homeland Insecurity, The Rise and Rise of Global Anti-Terrorism Law, joins me now. Professor Gearty, you're very welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you, Cormac. Good evening.
So you're pushing this argument for a boycott, academic and economic, instead of just continued diplomacy. Why?
Well, I think what we see with the International Court of Justice decisions, of which I'm sure the listeners and yourself know, that this business has become international and a matter of legal principle. And the business that has become, the need, the obligation on all of us, and not just governments, by the way, all of us, to do our bit to try and put pressure on a country that is involved in the most horrific abuses of international human rights and also engaged in what is now absolutely confirmed to be an unlawful occupation. I'm saying you could have a twin track. You could have the constant promise of a ceasefire around the corner, but you could also have the pressure, not dissimilarly to the pressure brought on South Africa, which was, of course, sporting as well as economic.
And what do you make of the argument put forward on this programme and others by Israeli spokespeople who say this is self-defence? They say what happened on October the 7th was abominable. It was an attack on their state and their people. And they say they want to eliminate the threat of Hamas and terrorism entirely on their doorstep.
Well, if they were being completely honest, and they said, and some of them indeed do, look, we don't care about the Palestinian people. They're vermin. They're animals. We don't care about international human rights. We want to kill them all. And one minister said we should starve them all to death, he said, but we're not let. I would abhor, but understand that position. I'd abhor it. No, they're hiding behind a notion of self-defence, but self-defence carries proportionality. You have to do something which is designed to be equivalent to the mischief caused. Now, the prosecutor in the ICC, the International Criminal Court, pointed out that there might have been IRA men in West Belfast, but Britain did not bomb West Belfast into oblivion. Now, Zionist apologists were furious about that analogy, but I think it holds. The test is proportionality. You don't wipe out a people because there has been a shocking obscenity, such as the attacks of 7 October.
By late August, the war threatened to spread out from Gaza. The Israeli army launched its biggest assault in the West Bank in decades. And at the same time, humanitarian organisations were fearful of the spread of the deadly disease polio in Gaza, which had been absent for 25 years from the territory. Here's UNICEF Ireland's Peter Power. At least 9 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank in what Israel says is a counter-terrorism operation. Since the October 7th Hamas attacks, the West Bank has seen a surge in violence, with more than 600 Palestinians killed there, largely in Israeli military raids. Ireland Executive Director with UNICEF, Peter Power, joins me now in studio to discuss all of this.
Yes, the West Bank, the humanitarian situation and the security situation in the West Bank has sometimes been forgotten in what when we look at what's happening in Gaza. But the last 2 years have seen a serious uplift in violence and violence against children, particularly in the West Bank. Over 600 people have lost their lives. That's a lot of people, many of whom our children, and this is the latest example of that. There has been deliberate targeting of schools and facilities in the West Bank, and we see this amongst settlers and the IDF. And let's remember, some Israeli children in the West Bank themselves have been killed. So, like nobody's immune from this. But to a large extent, what is happening in the West Bank has been forgotten. I was there literally this week last year. I was in the West Bank, and the situation of the Palestinian people there they're constantly being encroached upon, and the humanitarian situation there is not good, and it's obviously deteriorating all the time.
And it has taken an absolute disaster, that is Gaza right now, to kind of blow that off the front pages, so to speak. Can we talk about, let's start with the polio, the risk of polio and the efforts to vaccinate against polio in Gaza. How difficult will that be, do you think?
The first thing to say is, amidst all of the carnage, all of the devastation in Gaza, all of the loss of life, why polio and why such a concern? The fact is that polio has the capacity to spread like wildfire, particularly in an environment like Gaza, where people are constantly moving. There's very little water sanitation and hygiene. People are always on the move. And polio, as we know from our history here in Ireland, is a devastating disease for children. And if it takes off in Gaza, it could lead to a very, very serious situation on top of everything else.
And we know that a 10-month-old baby has been paralysed already by polio there.
one already, and three children have already been diagnosed with polio, and also tests of the water and the sewerage system show that the type 2 polio virus is now out in the wild there.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to stop its transmission is by a mass vaccination campaign. It's an extremely complex operation. UNICEF brought in 1.2 million vaccines on Sunday. We're bringing in another 400,000 this week. We will work with the WHO and UNRWA, and with 700 medical teams on the ground to deliver these. But we do need a humanitarian pause in order to do this. How anybody could prevent that from happening, I do not know, because we're talking about the lives of children here.
Yeah.
And remember, polio was eradicated mm-hmm. in Gaza 25 years ago.
But if it takes a hold, what are the consequences?
Devastating. Oh, polio is a devastating disease. It's highly infectious, particularly in the environment that prevails in Gaza at the moment. Devastating for children. And there's only three places in the world where polio is out in the wild now.
We've tracked the story of Israeli hostage Almog Meir throughout this series. Here's his uncle, Avram, appealing for his release.
Now, there are breaking reports this evening that more than a fifth of the Israeli hostages being held in Gaza may be dead, according to an Israeli military assessment. 21-year-old Almog Meir was abducted by Hamas at the Supernova Festival on October the 7th, and his family have been campaigning relentlessly for his release in the 122 days since. I spoke with his uncle, Avram Meir, shortly before coming on air from Tel Aviv. The family have heard nothing directly since then from Almog. Is that right, Avram?
Right. We haven't heard anything from Almog. We heard in the beginning of December proof of life, which I don't know the source of it. We just know he is alive, but nothing more than that. Nobody saw him. We have no evidence that he's doing well. We just know he is alive.
And
until...
That,
mm-hmm. 60 days. In December, in the beginning of December, we got a sign of life. I don't know the source of it. I just know he is alive. He was alive
mm-hmm.
until the beginning of December.
Okay. And was that a phone call or how did that come about?
The intelligence told us.
Okay.
Because of that, they didn't tell us what does it mean. I just know he was alive.
Okay. And the family, Avram, must be clinging to that hope now. Which brings me to today's news, breaking in the New York Times, speculation that at least 32 of the remaining 136 hostages captured by Hamas may be dead, they say. How difficult is this news for the family?
Again, it's a knife in the stomach. Again, it's part of the roller coaster that we are living in. I heard about it also. I don't know what does it mean yet. I'm looking for answers also because it just has been published in the last minutes, as far as I know. And I'm looking for answers also and significance. But generally, every news like this turns us upside down.
He was finally released in June from an apartment in central Gaza, which resulted in multiple casualties. Here, on July 6th, he speaks about his time in captivity.
If he wants to talk about it, so be with him, but not to suck information out of him. On the first floor, there was living a family. They told us that in this family, there were five children. They never saw them. They just heard them. They had nothing to do all day long. So they played cards, and they just told us that the thing they don't want to see anymore in their life, it's cards. For us, it's a miracle. And for the Israeli people, it is a very big joy. It's unbelievable, the happiness it gave to the people of Israel.
We We often spoke with Irish-Palestinian man Zach Hania during the year. He was trapped in Gaza for 7 months during the war before managing to escape to Ireland through the Rafah crossing. We sat down with him to get his reflections on his time in war-torn Gaza and his thoughts on the future for Gaza. If I was to ask you, Zach, to look back at almost a year since October 7th last, and all that you have experienced personally and looking as an observer now as well, what are your reflections?
There is a deep sadness inside my heart. It was the case when I was in Gaza, and now when I see the news every day, I try to follow up and see what is going on. I am in a state of shock. I was, and I still, and it's not going away. And every day we lose people, 40, 50 people killed and many injured. And every day we see the bad news about the injured people, injured and killed children and women, and the destruction in every part of Gaza. It's really a very hard experience. It's the worst experience that anyone can go through. It's not easy to handle. I feel that we survived, thank God, physically, but mentally, not mentally. We didn't survive mentally, and it's still haunting us. The images we...
Can I ask you about that for a second, Zach? Because that's something that people don't talk about too much, and you've been through so much personally. You were trapped in Gaza, you were trying to be for a long, long time to be reunited with your family, and we've discussed this extensively and regularly throughout the program on Drive Time throughout the year. And we talked to you in May when you finally managed to get out and be reunited with your family. How much of a mental toll did that take?
It's unmeasurable, and it's unbelievable, and it's very difficult to even describe. I was separated, and with my family, they left in November. They were evacuated, and I stayed there until May. It's like, you know, when we were in Gaza, we expected death any moment. We've seen death. We've seen our, like, neighbors, relatives, houses destroyed, and people, even until now, they still, like my neighbors and some of my wife's relatives, they still under their houses, under the rubble, since last year. When we were in Gaza, we were expecting to be killed any moment. So we were waiting for death. Imagine living like daily under this pressure, under this fear. It's very exhausting mentally. And we were like, you know, even I want to mention that something that illustrates, you know, the state of fear that we were living. In November, my wife, she wrote like a letter for me and for the kids. And she was in the letter, she was expecting herself to be killed. And she wanted to write something for us, like, you know, to be for our memory. And she was like fearing, and she was feeling that she is going to be killed. And she wrote one letter for me and for the kids, and giving advices and, you know, word for memory. So it's very hard moments, and it's very hard time when we were there. And even we are safe, thank God, still mentally is, we survived, as I said, physically, but not mentally.
And then your wife wrote that letter, Zach, given all that was happening. And we've spoken with you on the program about losing 10 members of your family in this conflict. So when your wife wrote that letter, she was really writing her last words. That's how she felt, I'm sure.
Yeah. That was when we were all in the northern part of Gaza. We were in our house. That's the time when she wrote it, and she was feeling, yeah, that's any moment she will be killed. And that's, she wrote, like, you know, the last words for us to, you know, for our memory, you know.
Do you remember anything from that letter? Does anything, I'm sure anybody in that position, there would be something from the letter, I'm sure, whirring around in your head on a daily basis. Does anything stand out?
She was, she was saying that she loves us, and she was giving me, like, you know, advices to look after the kids and stuff like that.
That's not easy. It's not easy, and it's just given all that you've
and
lost.
And you feel like when I recall, you know, the memories and some of the critical moments that we've been through, it really brings, you know, tears to my eyes. It was very, like, we were waiting for death. Imagine that you are sitting in your home in, or outside your home, and you were waiting, like, you know, any moment that you are going to die. And we lived in this fear for all. It's really mentally exhaustive, like, you know, for the people. And, you know, like, we lost, like, everything. We left our home. We lost our memories. Some, you know, photos, old photos for my parents, for my grandparents, and, you know, valuable little things that it's not, you know, you can't buy it, you know?
Yeah.
And we left everything, and we were not allowed to carry anything, just clothes we were wearing and a small bag of food or something.
You've had a year from hell, Zach, you and your family. And it's frightening to think that almost a year on, people are still living that nightmare on a daily basis. And it begs the question, as we approach the year anniversary of this current conflict, this current episode, how can Gaza come back from this? How can the Palestinian people and Israel find a way to live together peacefully?
To be honest, I have been thinking all the time, and I try to contemplate and understand and to come to terms with what happens, and I'm not really able to understand. It's beyond my abilities to understand what we have been experiencing. You can't bring my sister back to life, or my nephew, or my aunt, or my friends, or my neighbors. It's all gone.
Thank you for listening to episode 4 of Drive Time In Depth, The War in Gaza. The War in Gaza is produced by Drive Time series producer Will Hanifin and presented by me, Sarah McInerney.
By me, Cormac O'Hara.
You can also listen back to the whole series on the RTE Radio Player app, rte.ie/podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.